This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, the podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Whitten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah.
And Keir Hansen.
Gallifrey Public Radio. Now we have maths.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 81 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we cast ourselves headlong into the vortex with neither a direction nor impulse to lead on, take on adventures that would shape the very lives of species for millennia to come, find ourselves facing adversaries both new and ancient, formidable foes who prepare to obliterate us with no more thought than a moment's breath, and smile broadly, toss a few yards of knit cloth over a shoulder, and happily offer them a jelly baby. My name is Keir, joining us in the GPR studios this evening. Glad to have you with us. And along with me is Jay. Sir, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic. How about yourself?
Outstanding. Outstanding. We've been looking forward to this for a while.
Oh, yeah, we have.
Continuing in with our walk through exemplary episodes and representations of each of the Doctor's incarnations, we are now into our fourth installment. So it is Tom Baker time.
Yes, it is. And I mean, this, when you think about it, I mean, you know, a lot of us try and get the Nuvians into the classic stuff. And you know, when we do, we're not saying start with an unearthly child and work your way forward. I mean, that's one, it's impossible. Two, it's just horrible. I mean, when we say that you need to watch more classic stuff, this is the glorious bastard that we really want you to see.
Absolutely. And honestly, maybe this is just kind of a generational thing, but this is some of our, you know, at least on this side of the pond, this is some of our initial exposures. You know, this is some of our origin stories with our exposure to Who because of PBS carrying it in the off hours and things. And we would, you know, as I've mentioned to a number of people before, you know, I had been over at a friend's house. I think it was about second grade. We were trying to watch Trek because he was a blossoming Trekkie at the time. And when that was over, we switched one station over on the dial, and there was this insane-looking, you know, British mop-headed, grinning madman, you know, running about from, I believe it may have very well been bubble wrap monsters. I'm not entirely certain, but it was, I had no idea what I was seeing, but it was so jarring that that I ended up seeking it out and finding out more about it. So, you know, it's... We keep saying through each of these installments about how each actor's era propelled the show in a new direction or infused it with a new life or did something, you know, particular with it that just kind of, you know, either revitalized or changed the direction, reversed the polarity, or did something with it. You know, this, I don't think you could say anything more about or give a greater example of how that was done than Baker's era, you know, from 75 or so onward. Just incredible in terms of the appeal and the approachability of his performances and the material he was given.
Yeah. I mean, listener Stargate Pioneer, when, you know, he was talking to me about this past week, he said, you know, without Tom Baker, Doctor Who never would have made it to the 80s, and he could still play an effective Doctor today. And we actually saw that in the 50th special. But he said, without Tom and Tennant, the series would have been canceled decades ago. And I mean, okay, it's an unfair statement in some to some extent, because, you know, who knows what would have happened. But he's right, though. It's Tom Baker shaped this show, and he brought it to everybody. You know, I mean, when you think Doctor Who, you think Tom Baker. That's one of the first things that pops into your head, unless you haven't seen him.
Right.
Yeah.
And and even for you know, new Whovians who have not had, you know, all of that that exposure to some of these origins or some of these earlier adventures, it's kind of a well, maybe I can say kind of a respect for elders sort of thing. They get it. they understand that people who are really passionate about their fourth doctor associations and all the things that that carries with are legitimate. You know, they have a certain amount of reverence for that, even if they haven't had their exposure yet.
Right.
And we're hoping that they will.
One of the things that you get with the fourth doctor is that there is a lot to choose from. I mean, he was the doctor for, 7 years, I believe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which, I mean, longer than anyone else has played him. So, I mean, that's a lot of content to get through. So there's tons of stuff to get through. So we had a task figuring out what we were going to pick. I know
what to leave in and what to omit. I mean, there are obviously going to always be a few instances of some episodes where you could say, you know, that's a one shot. I can now say that I've seen it once and I can kind of move on from it. You know, enjoyable for certain, you know, maybe a couple of lines of dialogue or a certain situation that kind of strikes you as entertaining or interesting. But if we're looking into these as ones that either are just really, really particular standout performances, you know, start to finish from a production standpoint to a dialogue standpoint to a performance standpoint, or ones that really have a profound impact on the entire Hooniverse, so that we can start to see, oh, okay, now we've got, you know, either an origin story or a first occurrence of a big bad or something of that sort, then, you know, those are what we tend to earmark, which helped us a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, over this past week or so, I was looking at a list of about I want to say about 18 different stories that I thought could be worth. And then I said, all right, in terms of sheer rewatchability, that trimmed down a few. Then I said, all right, well, what about approachability to someone who has not really seen a whole lot of Baker's work before? Well, that trimmed a few more, because it's kind of one of those things where you go back and you see more and more of his material. And once you really grasp his style, and he definitely has a very particular style, which we'll get into the influences that's had on later performers. But so that knocked a few off. And then there were just ones where you said, okay, there's some production quality in this one. We want to Ark in space. Leave that one out of there. But I'm really happy with the ones we were able to narrow down to.
Yeah, so. I mean, I had the same problem, you know, with the first three doctors, and looking forward, I've always been able to say, okay, it's between these two, three, you know, just a handful at most that, you know, it's very easy to weed through. And with this one, once I got down to my top 10, I was ecstatic that I had gotten that far, you know. And, but yeah, like you said, you know, working through it and figuring out all the different aspects that we were looking for, I was finally able to come up with my recommendation for this week, which was Genesis of the Daleks. And I mean, this was, you know, a very aptly named story, as this is, you know, this shows us the creation of the Daleks, the whole story between the Khaleds and the Thals, and how Davros just takes things to another level and creates the Daleks as we know them today. Mm-hmm. And I mean, this is just a great story, you know, First, the fourth doctor getting yanked away from his journeys, and the Time Lord's basically saying, no, go clean this mess up for us real quick. Here's a ring. You can use that to get back when you're done. Lose it within the next 5 minutes so we can stretch this out. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, you know, we were talking last week about the fact that when we started getting into the Pertwee era, they started really incorporating a lot of thematic elements into their storylines. This is case in point. I mean, we're dealing with obviously another one of these instances of the futility of war, which is established. You know, you want that. Of course, we're going to go back World War One, throw yourself in the trenches, and take that backdrop, because that's case in point. Mm-hmm. It does also. I mean, with Terry Nation penning this, you know, you're in for something that's going to have some sort of a bludgeoned overtones to it, and he does do a lot of parallel between Davros and his developments towards the Nazi Party and that sort of a thing. You know, the idea of tweaking master races and that sort of establishment is a little strong at times. Maybe. But then also bear in mind the fact that they took the story and they actually pulled it out to 6 episodes.
Yeah. And I mean, you're dealing with the Daleks and the things that led to this race that just, you know, ultimately all they want to do is kill everyone else. So it really does fit. So you're going to have some heavy overtones to it. I mean, it kind of goes part and parcel. But I mean, there's a lot to be gotten out of this too. I mean, through the majority of this, we've got Sarah Jane running off on her own. and handling herself really well. I mean, she's integral to this being resolved.
Absolutely.
You know, but I mean, she gets pulled away from the doctor within the first 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here we've got her running around, almost dying, saving lives, doing this, that, and the other. And I mean, it's just really great to see a female companion given that kind of presence, because up to this point, we really haven't seen that. You know, they've been helpful at times and gotten in the way more often than not and been eye candy for the most part. And here we have, you know, someone saying, okay, no, we need another character to go and run this. Well, Harry's rough with the doctor. Let's give him Sarah Jane. Let's actually have her play a part in this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And she really is, you know, when she's out there kind of fending for herself on the Scaronian wastelands, you know, and fending for herself, you know, among the mutos and that sort of thing. It's the signs of it's the beginning of something you're going to see quite a bit through the Baker era. I mean, it happens again when we start dealing with Leela. It happens again with Romana. Baker was fortunate enough to be partnered or sided along with some very, very strong female characters for his companions. Or if they didn't begin that way, they evolved into those positions in very short order. And I think that worked out well because of the fact that they ended up becoming these representatives of stability when he was off his nut. So That kind of gave you the counterpoint and made him stand out even more as this sort of a brilliant madman when he had a very capable or get the job done female character at his side. Well, Leela might be different. She wasn't going at it intellectually. She's going at it with a knife in her teeth, but that was a slightly different point.
It was hot. We're okay with it.
But we'll get to her in a minute. We're dealing with our beloved Sarah Jane here.
Yeah. And you know, then we've also got the Doctor and Harry paired up throughout the majority of the story. I mean, and those two really did have a rapport. I mean, it was very, very reminiscent of the second Doctor and Jamie. You could tell they were friends. They enjoyed being around each other. The banter between them was priceless most of the time. You know, and they're both capable, and you can understand why the fourth Doctor has Harry along with him. He's part of the team, and it really does show in this story.
There are some aspects of the story too that I like that I guess you kind of have to point out, not only to Terry Nation's writing, but the director, David Maloney. They decided that they were going to be, since we're dealing with an origin story here. I mean, we set this up. We had the second story back in the Hartnell years, where we knew that we were already sort of in the post-war period between the Thals and the Khalids, and we were dealing with this. And it's really interesting to see that they were going to back up farther and give us a little bit more of this opportunity. But in doing so, I'm going to let you get to the moment.
Okay.
Because that's kind of, you know, your baby on this. But having some of the Khalids actually portrayed as, I'm not going to say benevolent, but not quite as quick to annihilate and things of that sort. This is going along with those sorts of Nazism themes where they're saying, well, were they following orders? Was this part of their dogma? Was this matter of, you know, did they have independent thought in this, or was it a matter of a mass propaganda and brainwashing, or did they really, you know, it's of that caliber, but which is always going to be a pretty enthralling concept to be able to work through, but it's interesting to see that done with, well, when you're your representative in the room is Tom Baker, doesn't always go at it with the degree of seriousness until
and until you're dealing with the idea of genocide. You know, the doctor gets to the point where he realizes, I have to take out this incubation room. He's got some explosives, and he gets it all set up, and he's ready to go, and he's sitting there with the two wires, and he's just got to touch them together. And I mean, this, you see this scene everywhere. They play it back, and it's, you know, the most memorable scene in this whole story, where he's sitting there with the wires, and he's asking, you know, have I the right? What gives me the power to decide whether this race lives or dies? And, you know, he's really struggling with it for a good while. And, you know, finally he gets interrupted and he's like, oh, thank God, I don't have to make this choice anymore. So, I mean, it's, you get him to that point, and then don't let him make the decision. You know, he doesn't make the decision to spare the Daleks, but he also doesn't have to make the decision to kill them all off. And I mean, it kind of felt like a cheap, almost, you know, get out of jail free card. But at the same time, it's how do you resolve that? You know, I mean, we've seen recently what the whole genocide thing does to the Doctor. And this is way too early on. You don't want to do that with your hero. I mean, yes, we've seen him kill people and we've seen him, you know, do things that, you know, your typical hero wouldn't really approve of, but this is a step too far. But at the same time, it's the Daleks. You can't let them go. So, I mean, it was a rather elegant way of resolving that. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, later on, there's a Dalek rolls through the hallway and connects the circuit and winds up blowing the room up anyway. So,
well, you think about this, and a lot of people have kind of started to look at this particular dilemma and how it didn't always adhere in quite the same way as the centuries go on, because that decision to hold back, that going with the moral choice, which isn't necessarily the best choice, is something that continues to eat at him for, you know, regeneration after regeneration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he knows that the massacres are going to continue by letting it go, including all of his own Time Lords.
Mm-hmm.
He knows that there's another point where Seventh Doctor, in remembrance of the Daleks, has to manipulate. It leads him to manipulate Davros, again, another one of their encounters, into actually destroying the surface of Skaro. You know, you've got imparting of the ways. Emperor Dalek, you know, addresses the Doctor and says, "Hail the Doctor, the great exterminator." Yeah. You know, I mean, he has become the coming storm, you know. So, but it's, you get that brilliant little bit of poetic justice, that little literary moment where, you know, Davros has created this species of monsters hellbent on, you know, on xenophobic slaughter, and at the end of it all, they execute him for being inferior.
Imagine that.
So yay. So just, you know, take that as a helpful tip there the next time you're thinking about taking out an entire species.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to be up to snuff. Again, you're going back to that that parallel. You know, the fact that if your master race among the Nazi standards, we're going to be the blonde haired, blue eyed, you know, 6'1", you know, perfect physique, and then you had Hitler, who wasn't quite so.
Not so much.
Yeah, but it's a fascinating metaphor. It's a great origin story. Mm-hmm. It's great performances from the companions. Yeah, and in terms of the parallels with Harry and Baker, along with Jamie and Troughton, are just wonderful. It's great when you get those sort of buddy cop,
yeah,
kind of opportunities.
Yeah, and one of the things that I really did enjoy about this is right at the very end when, you know, when they're, the show's about to wrap up and Sarah Jane asks the Doctor, you know, why do you seem okay with this? You know, the Daleks aren't destroyed. They're still there. You know, you said you just pushed them back about 1,000 years or whatever. And the Doctor's like, well, you know, I know that all of that massacre is still going to happen. All of the tragedies and everything that they're going to bring about. And it just makes me think, how much good is going to come from that? You know, and that, I mean, that just kind of summed up the Fourth Doctor for me. Is he knows that there's balance in the universe. Now, if they're going to bring all of this tragedy and all of this heartache and everything like that, you know, amazing things are going to happen to counteract it. And that just seems very Tom Baker to me, very Fourth Doctor. And that no matter how bad things get, there's always something to counteract it. And he may not be there to witness it, but he knows it exists and that's enough for him.
It's one of the things that they did quite a bit with his dialogue and the writing when you start to get around to these couple of years, is they really start playing around with the fact that he's seeing things on multiple paths.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the fact that he's probably more you talk about how some of the regenerations don't quite have as much cognizance of their previous. And being able to recall much of their previous knowledge or previous regenerations, he has I would say considerably more clarity. Mm-hmm. In that regard. Granted, he's got more of a body of work to be able to tap back into, But they play with that quite a bit. And the fact that that leads him to be able to see things on more of a long view. So yeah, that line with Sarah Jane about knowing that from the tragedy, the hope arises and that sort of a thing is very indicative of the writing that they've been doing for him and continue to when you start to get into, well, some of our other choices tonight.
Yeah.
The next one we decided to tap into here. And again, this is because I had to leave some of the in-betweens by the wayside. And there are some good ones. So, I mean, I know, yes, we're suddenly jumping to 1977 here. But if you want to, I mean, you're not going to go wrong if you look back to Hand of Fear, Deadly Assassin, because then you've got, you know, a phenomenal, again, directed by David Maloney. And it's another Robert Holmes written script. Involves your master. Fantastic stuff. Seeds of Doom, really good one as well. And I know a lot of people are a big fan of Brain of Morbius. I personally, I'm just going to set that aside. but in terms of these particular gentlemen, I think that everyone, especially right now with the resurgence of popularity of anything Sir Conan Doyle, you definitely want to make sure you get your hands on Talons of Wang Chang. Great Sherlock send-up.
Yeah,
well, not even a send up. I think they actually do it very straight faced. I don't even think they're trying to mock it.
No, but you do get that impression when the Doctor first comes out and he puts on the Sherlock hat, and it's just kind of like, really, really. And he makes the line. He's like, "We don't want to be too conspicuous," and then puts the hat on. Very tongue in cheek, but it was fantastic though.
Absolutely, I mean, his throughout this one, there are some. It's a great period piece. And not just a standard period piece, because obviously you're dropping yourself into what are these race of people, Cockney. So, yeah. but it's the sets are gorgeous. The score is a lot of fun. It's not your usual kind of, you know, very keyboardy, you know, synth kind of score. This one is a much fuller orchestration.
Mm-hmm.
Uses a lot of the period songs. There's times when the Doctor's kind of, you know, one of the episodes he's kind of strolling around and he's. He's humming to himself, and he's humming tunes from the period, you know. So it's just it's interesting how they really put some of that really, really fine detail work into it. But this, what I really enjoyed about this story in particular is, well, aside from the fact that if you were not fully into accepting Leela as a kick-ass companion before, I mean – there are a dozen reasons to love her to death.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I mean, not to mention the fact that, well, we'll mention there's the wet t-shirt moment and all that, but that's, we'll put that entirely aside. But she's tough. She actually expresses a certain degree of humor. Watching her tear into a ham hock or whatever it was, and she was a rack of lamb with her teeth and whatnot. And then tackling villains with a knife, you know, leaping off of tables and whatnot and jumping out of windows. She's just amazing. But the fact that it brings out a very paternal / educator role from the Doctor. We've spent all our time talking about the roles the Doctor has portrayed. This is case in point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he has to be her handler through this entire thing, because she is, they even refer to her at one point. One of the baddies that's going to go push her off, you know, lock her into a cabin or something, refers to her as the tigress. And that's really what she is. I mean, she's just kind of a wild animal at times, but, really interesting to see the way that he handles that in educating her, but at times leaving her with the questions, because she's a catalyst, you know, and by letting her figure some things out on her own, it allows other paths to be set in motion.
Yeah. And I mean, I've got to say this, I found the addition of Mr. Sin, really, really creepy. And I mean, that's today. I was sitting here watching this today, like, man, that just weirds me out. I mean, it's a good costume, and it would have been brilliant at the time, but you know, nowadays it's just, we're used to better. So I'm looking at it like, okay, it's a person in a costume, but there was just some kind of creep factor that just kept getting to me. And I'm like, if I'd been watching this in the 70s, I'd have been like, you know, just absolutely terrified of that thing.
Well, there were a lot of moments where they did a lot of intermittent switching back and forth from mannequin to the dwarf actor and things. obviously, I think the last moment when he finally like picks him up and hurls him to the ground, kind of thing. It's look, the straw doll kind of.
Yeah.
But no, that was definitely legitimate. Did you notice? I kept expecting. I remember. I want to say it was back 6 years or so when I first saw this, but the whole reference to the fact that in order to get to, and you, everyone's going to have to add this to their vernacular, the Peking homunculus. In order for it to work, you had to have the brain of a pig. So you're picking up on the fact that Mr. Sin, when he's up on top of the dragon laser device there, mm-hmm. Is squealing.
No, I did not pick up on that.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting. Yeah. That I don't know whether that was intentional. They decided to put that in and just have some of his sinister little giggles and whatnot. But every once in a while, you'd hear wee wee. I'm like, okay, that's
I was just way too weirded out to even put that much thought into it. I was just like, oh man, just kill it. Just get done. I'm gonna go hide in the closet and just cry.
But I thought it was really interesting the fact that we were dealing with a villain who outright addressed and was concerned about the activities of the time agents. That was always very cool to kind of see that was incorporated there, because it meant that they were sort of playing into a longer arc as far as involving the time agents in there. Yet he did not really have a full working knowledge of who the Doctor was. So that was interesting to see that flip on it. Normally it's the other way around. Mm-hmm. I did also think I personally loved the two goofs, the professor and Jaco.
Yes.
Running off. Their banter together as they're getting in and out of these scrapes or getting locked up, and it's phenomenal. And I'm going to say this again for people who keep coming down on some of the aspects of New Who, saying that they're trying to make it a little too funny at times, or that they're putting in characters that are unnecessary, that don't propel the story, they're just in there for comedic effect. Here is yet another example of the fact that it's been done all along.
Yeah. Yeah, it really has. And I mean, it works really well in this one too. And I think that's kind of the thing that is causing the disconnect now, is the fact that you have very, very serious moments, and then they're counteracted by Strax being, brilliantly hilarious, but and there's not so much of a blend. Whereas with this stuff, I mean, it fits in there properly. You get the deep moments, you get the serious nature of it, but then the humor doesn't cheapen that. Like, they did a really brilliant job of meshing the two together to make a solid story, instead of trying to cram them in together and, hoping that it comes out okay.
Right. So maybe it's a matter of a more deft hand in terms of using it as pressure valves rather than a complete scene breaker.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's what I've always said from the beginning, is that, Strax can be a brilliant character, and when he's handled properly, I mean, he really does add to the story and it makes it brilliant. But then you give it to someone who's like, the formula says insert comedic device here. Okay. Strax, make a funny line, and back to the serious nature. And it's just, you have to understand the flow before you can do that kind of thing.
Right. This was done in this particular story. It was more a case of, you'd have those opportunities where it was a cutaway from the action. You're now flipping over to your B story, or in some cases your C story. So it allowed you to be able to have a clear delineation between all of the more intense moments going on with our primary characters. And then, we join our two goofballs already in progress.
Yeah.
So. But I mean, while you do have a very down to earth, or not to say down to earth, but down to business Baker for the first half, I should say, of this story, mm-hmm. I mean, he puts away a lot of his usual devices. And he's very kind of, get to the action sort of thing. He's gathering his information, and he's not really, or it seems like he's not really going for the witty rapport all the time. And he's actually doing the sleuthing that everybody's crediting with doing. I'm thinking, wow, it's an interesting little break from this. But then, by the time he gets his footing and has a better understanding of what's going on, that twinkle comes right back. Eureka is Greek for "this bath is too hot,"
so
it's great stuff.
So I mean, one thing to remember going back into this, though, is that it did come from the 1970s, so their treatment of the Chinese characters might be a little bit jarring. Yeah, it's handled very differently than we would today.
But in honesty, though, also take the fact that when Robert Holmes was writing the script and drawing it, you know, headlong from Doyle, this was a lot of the representation and treatment of the immigrants into the Greater London area of the time. Oh, yeah. They were referred to as the Chinee. I mean, it was while horrible, it was period accurate. Mm. So maybe that's one of the reasons why they decided to say, well, no, we're going to paint this true, mm-hmm. But we know better.
Yeah, and I mean, it wasn't done in bad taste. I mean, that's the thing is that, yes, they kept it accurate, but it wasn't, you know, they didn't shove it in your face and they didn't drop it every other line because they can, because it's accurate and whatever. I mean, they did it in very good taste. It's just, I mean, I know sitting watching it today, I was just kind of like, oh, that's different. That's a little off. But I mean, it doesn't. As long as you're prepared for it going in, it's not that bad. I mean, if you pay attention to it, it's not horrible. So just, you know, a little asterisk on this one.
But, yeah, it's, I think this is also one of those few instances where you've got a story that they pull out to, and Baker's stories typically range anywhere from 3 to 6 episodes, some slightly longer. So, but this one has the pacing and has the content where, you know, you get through all 6, you know, okay. I didn't really find that there was a particularly slow point in this one. You know, it propels itself well. You know, maybe a couple of moments where you're like, you know, you're watching the magic show or something like that. And you're thinking, okay, you could have just jumped to the end of this. I didn't really need to see him insert and remove all of the swords into the cabinet there. And the one he dropped at the end, did you notice that?
Yeah.
Last one he pulls out, he grabs it by the blades. Oh, it's stuck in the cabinet. Oh, hell. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. And it's one of those ones where it's enjoyable for people that you didn't really need to have a whole lot of understanding of any of the temporal elements or things of that sort. You could go into it as a Holmes appreciator and get something from it.
Yeah, but then the next one that we get on the list, you really can't avoid the time travel aspects of it.
No.
Nor
should you avoid it for any reason.
No, absolutely not. I mean, you can't put a list of 4th Doctor stories together without including City of Death. And this is the ultimate in 4th Doctor stories. It is fantastic in every way, shape, or form.
Yeah. It's you take it this is one of their first location shoots where they actually decide to leave the Greater London area and shot this actually a great degree of it for their location pieces in Paris proper. Mm-hmm. You notice how there's a theme song that mm-hmm. runs through this entire thing, and it happens every time they're running through the streets of Paris. I got to the point where we're watching it again, and I'm humming to myself, running through Paris, running through Paris, running through Paris. I'm like, oh, okay, great. It's got lyrics now. All right. But if you've been under a small Whovian rock for the last couple of decades and didn't know that this was actually written by a pseudonym for Douglas Adams, then you're just going to be greatly surprised by how clever and sharp and really well paced and structured the dialogue is. Even story aside, just the interchange between all of the characters, not just Baker and others, but even among, you know, Count and Countess and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's just brilliantly executed.
You know, I mean, brilliant cameos by John Cleese. I love the part that he's in. It's the snobby art critic.
it's brilliant because it's just it's kind of something that just sort of sums up this entire episode. Although the scene where the Doctor, Romana, and Duggan are first brought in and they have to talk with the Countess, you know, when he's first brought in by the butler, who is, I love him, he's so violent, you know, is probably, in my opinion, the best classic Doctor Who scene ever written, because he's thrown in literally.
Yeah.
You know, he greets her by, you know, wobbling up on his knees, has this great exchange, introduces them all, sits them down. Romana has this great moment where she's like fumbling around, or she picks up the puzzle box. The Countess says, you're never going to figure it out. And within 30 seconds, boop, oh, this. it's stitched together perfectly. Mm. And Duggan is like the best patsy, blunt object character you could possibly rely on. You know, you need somebody knocked out. Do you need a door broken down, stone wall bashed through? Just point at him and tell him, you know, Duggan, smash. And he just goes running off. Phenomenal. I loved so much of this in terms of the casting. Now, Julian Glover, Skyroth, brilliant. When you're not looking at the rubber green head or whatever, was just great, though, because he's always so perfectly dressed. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got to have that little green in there, no matter which era you're seeing him in. But as you mentioned, this is a great time travel episode. It plays around with a lot of great concepts in there that have been used since.
Yeah.
This is yet another, and everybody can go ahead and wrestle with these as they want, because I know through all of Who, they have messed with this a lot. It's another Homo sapien origin story. Well, it's actually all of Earth life's origin story. And they're saying that it was because of the Jaggeroth and their ship blowing up back 400 million years ago, providing enough radiation to spark the first primordial soup. But we've got the idea of not being able to mess with time once it's been established. You know, you've thrown your dice. You know, you don't get another shot at it. You've got the idea of going back and planting things for later use in terms of the writing. This is a fake all over Da Vinci's, what he calls boards, canvases, essentially. It's just, there's a lot of great elements to it. The playing with the time bubbles, you know, the chicken or the egg to the chicken to the egg again, and all those aspects. A lot of great time techie discussion. So much to chew on.
Yeah. And I mean, this is the kind of thing that I love seeing in this show is, you know, the Doctor has a time machine. You know, it makes sense to use it. You've got, you know, the Skaroth who is scattered across time and can basically communicate with all of his different iterations all throughout, you know, history and uses that to full advantage, you know. And then you've got the Doctor who's kind of tracing what's going on. And I mean, he uses the TARDIS. He's like, oh, okay, well, I need to go back here to, you know, Renaissance Italy and, you know, speak with Leonardo da Vinci so that I can fix this. And then I'm going to go forward real quick and pick up the item that I told him to do. You know, it's just, it's a great, I mean, Douglas Adams understands the flow of time travel.
Absolutely.
And he really used it to full effect. And I mean, this is the kind of thing that when you think, okay, why doesn't the Doctor just use his time machine to fix this? This is the kind of thing that we're looking for. And it's just brilliantly done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and take some of those aspects, take some of those ideas of putting them into Adam's hands, who just had that degree of clarity, so that when he started putting pen to paper and started playing with these ideas, he had a far better understanding because of his own interest and his own passion for figuring out some of the intricacies of the entertaining aspects of applying these very theoretical sciences. You know, it's one of the things that he's just, that made him as brilliant of a writer as he was. So now you give him the opportunity to do that with a cast of characters that can really bring it forward or put it into, breathe life into it in a way that we can somehow hope to grasp, unless we're Duggan, in which case, you know, he goes, is there any point where I get brought into this conversation? You know, he's just going to stand back there and shake his head. But I think it's one of the reasons why I personally, I found that this episode was so near and dear, because I'm a voracious reader of anything I can get my hands on that Adams had written, whether it was completed or incomplete works and things of that sort. And this is because he had a particular voice a writer's voice that I clicked with, and putting it into Baker's hands in terms of the way that he was able to play with the wit and the that very off kilter delivery and nature of it, that in terms of just the wrong reaction to any situation, things are at their most intense, their most dramatic, you know, gun to your head or a laser, you know, bearing down on you, and grin and crack a joke and, you know, disarm somebody with something completely random. And that was just what made him absolutely brilliant. And Adams was able to feed that machine like nobody else could.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if there was anyone that was tailor-made to write for the Fourth Doctor, it definitely would have been Douglas Adams. And I'm mad that we didn't get more from him. But at the same time, it makes this one all the more amazing that, you know, it's just this great little bundle of Fourth Doctor fantasticness that we can unwrap anytime we want.
There's also, there was a point that you wanted to make in terms of, and it was the same thing that that was actually expressed in my household, in terms of when it comes to Baker's delivery or Baker's particular style with the Doctor, which is so boiled down, so succinctly displayed in this story, but in terms of his ability to come either busting or stumbling into a room to face a room full of guns or something of that sort, and, oh, hello, it looks like you were expecting me, and that kind of a, you know, that sort of a thing, remind you of anybody?
Just slightly, maybe our favorite 10th Doctor.
Yeah, just a bit.
Just a touch.
So, and if you don't, if you can't see that in this episode, or I should say in the story, then you need to start like flipping back and forth. One and one.
Yeah, and we were talking about this before we started recording that, you know, the Tennant has always come out and said that the fifth Doctor was his Doctor. And I mean, the time lines up. I mean, that would have been who was playing the Doctor and everything. And I mean, it's, you can tell that he is influenced to some extent from Davison, but the way that he portrays the Doctor really seems a lot more influenced by Tom Baker. I mean, there's so much in their delivery and the way they act. And I mean, Tennant was far more not absolutely crazy, but, but I mean, that was, you can tell that there was that influence there. It very strong in his performance. So I don't know. Anyone that loves the 10th Doctor, going back to the 4th Doctor is not going to be that difficult. Yeah, you might have a hard time with the bubble wrap monsters, but sure. With changing to the 4th Doctor, you're going to be fine.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, and that's exactly the path that some of our listeners had taken in terms of their transitions around. So it's I remember, was it well, I'm trying to think exactly the order that he ended up going through them. I'm referring to our listener, Bobby, who was saying that he had gone. Did he go through all of New Who in order before jumping back? And when he jumped back to Classic, he jumped directly to Baker?
I think so. I don't think he ever told us whether he went through all of New Who in order. But yeah, it's, I think Baker was the first one that he went to in Classic Who, which, you know, more power to you, because that's the right way to do it.
Yeah. And again, you know, and we mentioned this earlier in terms of accessibility to it. There's a great number of them on various DVD sets, and Netflix does have a couple of the stories on there as well. But you will find, as far as availability for DVD in particular, you'll be able to get tons of Baker's material. You had actually mentioned, Jay, about other episodes, or wishing that we had more episodes from Douglas Adams. You got to bear in mind that he did write two other episodes, or two other stories.
He did.
He wrote Pirate Planet, which is actually pretty good. But he also wrote Shada, or Shada, depending on how you want to pronounce it, which was never televised.
Right.
So we'll talk about those later. But no, this one in particular, he just had written under that pseudonym. So when you saw David Agnew on the credits there, no, well, D.A.
Right.
He didn't stray far.
Yeah.
But
yeah. So, I mean, but like we said, there's plenty of Fourth Doctor stories. And I mean, we had a hard time thing it down. I mean, what are some of the other titles that you had that you wanted to include?
Well, as I mentioned, Deadly Assassin is a really good one to put up there. And it was one of the ones that was like the last one that I wanted to think to include. We want to make sure we're not running too long on this. We could talk for hours about all
easily.
Invasion of Time is a really strong one to grab a hold of. Brain of Morbius is again, it's one of those ones where it's a good backstory episode. But I'm thinking particularly of well, and this tends to happen. It tends to be kind of when you maybe they know that the light is starting to blink. But when you get down to the Baker's last few episodes, when you get into Keeper of Trakhan, into Logopolis, you know, and you're dealing with again, you know, last moments for Master and those things. Those are definitely some great ones to grab a hold of. In fact, that whole trio, Keeper of Trakhan into Logopolis and onward, are a great set to be able to see, because it's not only phenomenal work from Baker, even though, well, falling from a radio tower, but also gives a really nice, you know, if you've done this as a sort of a subset, all right, well, I'm just going to grab six Tom Baker stories and just kind of really get a good understanding of them, but I don't want to watch all of it because there's just too much content. Go ahead and pick those through. Use these two. Use Keeper and Logopolis as your last ones, because that'll give you a nice transition, a really comfortable transition into what is a really good Davison episode for fifth.
Yeah.
So it's kind of win-win there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of the ones that I was thinking of, I know like a lot of people can't stand it, but one of the early ones that I came into when I went back into Classic Who was Ark in Space. And I mean, yeah, we've made many references to the bubble wrap monsters. And I mean, it's so clearly like, here, look, we have green cellophane, wrap it around your arm and act like you're in pain, you know, but it was actually a decent story or decent basis for a story. And it was just executed poorly, you know, but,
right.
But I mean, the interaction between the Doctor and companions and, you know, it's not too bad if you can pull out, if you, all right, no, it's horrible, but still it's there. it's got a spot in my heart just because of when I saw it.
No. And that's absolutely valid. And there's some great dialogue between Sarah Jane and Baker. You know, it's actually one of the ones where, it has that great exchange. It's like, it's one of those ones that's always been burned into my memory where, doctor says something to the effect of, you know, you humans and your limited minds, it makes me wonder why I like you so much. And she just, you know, and she's just kind of skipping along behind him, a couple steps behind. Oh, that's because you have excellent taste.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
So it is enjoyable in its own right. Another one I think that I don't know if it's, I don't think it's one of the Netflix episodes, The Mask of Mandragora, which was sort of a, they started out writing a what was going to be a vampire. They were going to write a Dracula story.
Okay.
Just like this time around, they were doing a Holmesian story. They got into this idea that they were going to have a couple of stories each season that had some sort of a familiar underpinning and just do a Doctor Who flip on it. Mm-hmm. But they didn't like where it was kind of headed. And they decided to do the Mandragora and what was another one? Oh, and A Horror of Fang Rock.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was the whole, with the lighthouse and the Rutans and whatnot, and really interesting that you had a Rutan without the Centaurans. But hey, you got to have both sides of the coin, I suppose.
Yeah. But then another one, and this was actually the pick for the BBC America Doctor Revisited stories, was the Pyramids of Mars. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I love this story. This actually is the very first Doctor Who that I ever came across as a kid. You know, I'm flipping through channels, kind of like you were talking about earlier, and I happened to come across this, and I was like, this is different. I mean, it's sci-fi elements, but you know, I'm used to my dad pushing, you know, Star Trek The Next Generation on me, and I'm kind of like, I don't quite, it's interesting, but I can't, and you know, it just, for some reason, it stuck with me. And when I came to it as an adult, like my whole head just exploded, and I was like, oh my God, it all makes so much sense now. And I sat there and I watched the entire thing start to finish without moving. I'm not even sure I blinked, you know. But I mean, it is really a fun and fantastic story, and just the interplay between the Doctor and Sarah Jane throughout it is fantastic stuff.
Definitely so. And for those of you who like to be completionists, or you're really, I should say completionists, but you like to know all of your points of origin, you could always go back and grab a hold of The Invisible Enemy so that you can have K-9's premiere.
Yay!
It's good as well. Did you notice also, though, there's a point in, what was it? Oh, it was in City of Death, where Doctor first jumps into the TARDIS as he goes to hop back to see Leonardo. And you don't get to see him, but he opens up the door and goes, K-9, how are things in here? And the door closes.
Yes,
it's just little things thrown in. That got some cheers from the house here. But yeah, it's so much material. You really are not going to be ill-suited by grabbing any of them that you chose to. So queue up Netflix or get in the Netflix rentals or just head down to your local shop and grab some of the DVD sets. It's definitely worth the while. Because this is quite possibly the most iconic establishment of the Madman in a Box that you could possibly have.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got some news this week that is actually kind of exciting. I mean, we're starting to get to the point where they're filming things regularly now, so we're starting to get more information leaked to us. excuse me, sorry.
The role of Jay will be played next week by.
So let's see. Keeley Hawes actually opened up about her role in Doctor Who. She's going to be playing Miss Delphox.
Okay. And, yes.
And so she was coming out saying that, you know, it's very exciting and she had a lot of fun. And she was like, you know, it doesn't really feel like work. She didn't really give any information about what's going on in the show, but
no, we still know that she's just going to be an evil banker.
Yeah.
Of some sort.
But I mean, it's just kind of fun to hear people saying that, you know, it was a lot of fun and interacting with Peter Capaldi and Jenna Coleman. You can tell that they work well together. And, you know, any information like that that I get, I'm like, yay, this is good news. This is, you know, I mean, obviously they're not going to come on and be like, no, those two hated each other. You should have seen the looks they were giving each other. But to hear so many people saying that, you know, that they're working well together, it really makes me hopeful for the new series.
Mm, yeah. There's a lot of reasons to be looking forward to the news that we've been handed as far as where Series 8 is going to be going. All sorts of information that got kind of dumped out in the last issue of Doctor Who magazine. We've got a much fuller roster now. Mm-hmm. Well, not necessarily the roster, but also just an idea of some of the flow of the episodes as well that are going to be within the season. So. Yes, Jay had to remind me that while I do like to have tangible copies in my hands of these sort of magazines, and I have to wait long periods to have them actually sent over, you know, but yes, I can get it digitally. That's fine. It's just not the same. I can't put it in my coffee table without having to plug it in.
Well, get both. That way you can read it and get the information quickly, and, you know, then when the other one comes, you can just put it on the table in pristine order because you don't need to read it now.
True. Well, what was the information? What was the breakdown of the roster changes that we now have, Mr. Know-It-All?
Well, obviously the big news that we got actually just after recording last week, Tom Riley is the big one that came out. And apparently it's not saying in this story, but there's been a lot of talk saying that he's supposed to be playing a sort of Robin Hood role.
Yeah, I came across a couple of rumblings about that. I had a feeling that they were going to be doing, based on some of the location shoot photos and things like that, they were going to start considering some period pieces. They were doing some shots in parks. They were doing some things. They were out of standard costume and so forth. So maybe they're going to give us another historical piece. It'd be kind of cool if they did. I don't know. I don't think there was any basis for this, though.
Yeah, that's I can't remember where like the information came from. I just remember hearing a bunch of people like, oh yeah, it's Robin Hood. I'm like, really? Why is it Robin Hood? But
because we haven't done it yet.
It's the only one we've got left. But it is going to be Gatiss penning it, which makes me a bit reluctant.
Stop.
But it's a history piece, and he knows how to write history stuff. So it's I don't know. It could go either way at this point.
Just bearing in mind that that as we start to get some of these little scattered bits of information about the writing, the production schedules, and things of that sort, bear in mind that this show is done in block production. So what is shot and when it is shot has absolutely no bearing on what sequence any of the episodes air. So, you know, they do – is it a three block?
I think so.
Chunk? So, right. So taking these across – we might know where, you know, within that production block, which episodes, you know, they're saying, all right, well, they're because they do simultaneous filming as well to try and consolidate on set construction and some of the incidentals. But if they'll say, okay, this is the first, second, and third episodes within this production block, those may end up being aired episodes 6, 12, and 15. You know, there's no way of being able to link those together.
Yeah.
Hopefully, though, that means that with the underlying scripts, that there is a bit of oversight.
Hopefully.
Into where the stories are headed.
One would hope.
But. Yeah. Well, when they publish these articles and they say things like episode will be written by.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, they're already filming some things. So, you know, is the man in the big chair going to be paying close attention to the links that we attacked him so vehemently for in Series 7.
We'll find out. But we got a lot of other names dropped in that same article. Trevor Cooper, who last appeared in Doctor Who in 1985. Ian Hallen, David Benson, Roger Ashton Griffith, Paul Murphy, and Jimmy V, who has done a lot of work actually on Doctor Who. He was the Grasky, the Mox of Balhoon, and Bena Cafalata. And the Voyage of the Damned. A lot of people, you know, getting picked up and tagged to play roles. So, I mean, they're starting to hit it pretty hard and fast. So,
yeah,
it's exciting.
Well, at this point, yeah. And we'll be getting a lot of these little quick mentions, not really knowing what capacity or character representations or anything like that. But it's really the nature of the beast right now. It's impossible to not know that people are going to be involved in these things when anybody who is anyone that gets spotted walking in or out of the set locations is going to get tagged and mentioned. Or they're just going to do a little, hey, quick tweet, guess where I was today? And they just, you know, that's all they need to say and let it run from there.
Yeah, but in that same episode or issue of Doctor Who magazine, there was actually an interview with Paul McGann. They had asked him about, you know, about any future involvement in the show. And it was kind of interesting what he said. He responded and said, you know what? I don't expect to be involved again, but I expect I'll be surprised one day by something. That's what Doctor Who's all about. I expect to be surprised. Right. So I don't know if that means that it doesn't sound like he's saying, I don't want to be involved anymore, or I don't plan on it. It's just him saying that he doesn't think there's a spot for him moving forward.
Right. But no, I mean, he's always been very straightforward. I think he's, in all honesty, he's probably in the same sort of a position of knowing that any of us are, you know, or slightly more. I mean, he'd love to jump back into it at any point in any opportunity, because he does phenomenal material in terms of what he puts into the Big Finish productions and continues to put those out. So it's great that we have that extended content to work with. But I think Night of the Doctor was a bit of a surprise to him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It wasn't like they said, you know, keep your schedule clear if you don't mind.
Yeah, no, it was pretty much just like, hey, are you doing anything this weekend? Can we get you for 2-3 hours, something like that? Yeah. And I mean, honestly, that was some of the best stuff to come out of Wales in a while now. Mm. Yeah, so I'm all about, you know, just bringing him back in for little bits and pieces here and there.
We had been hoping about the idea of little webisode installments or something of that sort to fill in some of the pieces.
And they haven't come through yet.
But I don't know if they're listening to us yet, so talk bigger.
So some other news that we got, Matt Smith was actually speaking at a con previously at a WonderCon. And someone had asked him about the regeneration in the Christmas special and if he was okay with it. And he said that they had actually shot many, many different versions of it. And he said one of them, the Doctor actually lost a leg. One of his quotes is, you know, we shot much more brutal, emotional, and troubling takes and stories in there. The actual take that was used is an interesting one for me. So, I mean, this could have been much, much different. And I mean, without further information to go on, I don't know whether or not they made the right choice, but yeah, it is kind of interesting to know that even up until the very end, they weren't sure how it was going to get handled.
And we've seen outtakes and deleted scenes from other pivotal episodes, you know, slightly different interpretations. Take Bad Wolf. You know, we've come across that entire deleted scene that could have had a dramatic change on where the show would have been headed.
Yeah, exactly.
The next few episodes. But, you know, and knowing, obviously, this is just something where, you know, they were trying out a couple of different things before they started really editing and taking it apart to see what played. But I think the public would be okay to be able to see some alternate takes just for the...
Oh, yeah, just for the fun of it and see what, you know, what could have been. I think that'd be very exciting.
Well, and traumatizing some of the movies. He lost a leg!
Why is the Doctor slicing Clara's throat? What the hell?
Because he was listening to too many critics, dear.
Yeah. It is exciting. I mean, it's kind of cool, and I would love to see these on, like, you know, the special edition or the special features and stuff on the DVD. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some cool stuff.
I think by the time that all rolls... Have you been noticing also that there has been some stirring of the waters again as far as them looking to push up season premiere date?
No, I didn't notice any of that.
Yeah, there was a couple of voices out there, and I'll have to if I can come across some of the quotes from individuals within the BBC as far as their programming that were, it's not something as far as intent, it's something as far as encouragement from the office desks upstairs to say it would be in our best interests if you could move this up as early as, you know, early August, late July. But that's really because it's a matter of, I think, from a dollars and cents standpoint, BBC may be looking at it as trying to keep the iron hot.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that is feasible, because if they meaning the production team proper, thinks that they have a certain amount of fixed time, you know, within certain range, but they set their schedules accordingly, you do not want to rush them.
Yeah. I was going to say, I never thought that I would hear myself say this, but for the love of God, wait. Yeah, we've waited this long. I wouldn't mind a few extra weeks just to make sure that it was right. You know, I would much rather, wait till the end of August, September, whatever it is, and get, even, 8 really well put together solid stories with some in there that don't really, then, looking back on the entirety of Series 8 being like, well, there were 2 of them in there that were all right. Yeah.
So, yeah, I think we're in agreement on that. I'd rather, if you think to yourself, if you had a project sort of laid out for yourself that you knew was going to take a fixed amount of time, and someone came in and said, it's really in your best interest if we can trim this by about 20%, crank it out 2 weeks sooner or 4 weeks sooner or what have you. But we still want you to maintain the quality of expectations. Take the time with it, because I think the backlash from something that gets rushed to final edit will be far more damaging than making the public wait for a couple of extra anticipatory weeks.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, at that point, just start building the hype. Put out those webisodes we were just talking about.
Yeah.
Give us those as filler. I'd much rather that.
Yeah, and they don't really even always have to be, little succinct short stories or anything of that sort. In fact, even those literal teaser webisodes that are 90 seconds long are enough to keep us interested, because right now it's all left to our imaginations, and imaginations for where the season is headed are running wild. Oh, yeah. So I would think that they'd have some fun with it.
Yeah.
They could show us things that are completely disconnected. You have five lines of conversation with a character we've never met before that are completely disconnected from anything that we know that's going to be happening. But just, it would, in terms of just getting the fan base to foam at the mouth with wondering what the hell is going on or what it all means, that I would think that, I'd enjoy doing it. I'd enjoy messing with people.
Hell, for some reason, something that sticks out in my mind is like seeing the Doctor with like almost like a beach ball or something, just sitting there staring at it and giving this little monologue or something, and just saying all these deep thoughts that really have no meaning whatsoever. And then at the very end, popping the ball and screen goes black. I mean, do you have any idea how much people would go nuts trying to figure out what it means?
Mm-hmm. And it would never even have to connect to anything. Yeah,
exactly. That's the great thing. It'd be a lot of fun.
But we're in for some fun as well when we go into next week, because then class is in session at that point. we start to deal with the our true classroom professor of a doctor in the form of Peter Davison, the man with the vegetable in his lapel.
Yes. Yeah, it'll be exciting. I mean, this is where things kind of we're going to have to start to do some digging, because this is really almost the beginning of the end for Classic Who. Yeah, in the Fifth Doctor era, it started to go downhill, and the Sixth Doctor, it really started to spiral, and the Seventh Doctor, it was, honestly, it was in its death throes. So it'll be kind of interesting to see what we can dig out of this.
But Jay's not being pessimistic before we do these next 3 weeks of recording.
No, I'm just saying it's kind of interesting to think of where we are in the show. I mean, with the First and Second Doctor, everything was building up at that point. And then with the Third and Fourth Doctor, we're at the peak. And so now we're sliding down the other side of the hill, and it's just kind of, it'll be interesting to see where it all kind of comes in.
True. But I think there are definitely some gems to be found.
Oh, absolutely.
And I know that we've got a number of listeners who actually are very near and dear to Fifth. So, and we're kind of hoping that we're going to be able to hear from them, throw the tweets out, throw the emails out to us and such to let us know. Because there's a definite charm to Davison's performances. Oh, yeah. that it would be worth finding those episodes that really make that stand out. If he was the real compassionate or concerned incarnation of our dear Doctor, then it's worth seeking out the episodes that really shine a prominent light on that. So, calling all cars on that one.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, this has been episode 81 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, you know, the very powerful and the very stupid have one thing in common. They don't alter their views to fit the facts. They alter the facts to fit their views.
And this is Keir saying the best way to know where you come from is to figure out where you're going and just work backwards.
We'll see you guys next week.
LLZ.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows by calling 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1477 to leave us a voicemail. You can head to GallifreyPublicRadio.com to leave comments on each episode. There you can also keep up to date on all the latest news and gossip, as well as what's going on in the community. Also make sure to head over to GunnaGeek.com to find out lots of other high-quality, geek-centered shows. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.